May it please the court, I'm Jennifer Koh. I represent the appellant, Peace Health St. Joseph Medical Center. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Very well.
The issue in this case is whether Judge Garrett commented on the evidence by asking an expert witness about his source of factual information. Evaluation of an alleged judicial comment on the evidence is a question of fact. I'm sorry, it's a question of law based on the facts and circumstances of the case and requires de novo review. Under the facts and circumstances of this case.
On the standard of review, how do we mix the different things together? We've got a constitutional question usually calls for de novo review. We've got a legal question calls for de novo review. We've got cases that say that a ruling on a motion for a new trial is an abuse of discretion standard. But those cases are all involve a situation where it was the actual trial judge who heard the motion, decided I screwed up, it made a difference, and that's what the appellate court defers to. But we don't have that here because there's somebody else making that ruling.
Correct.
How, if at all, do we parse out the application of these different standards of review to the four, five judicial utterances that were encompassed within the colloquy that's at issue?
So, first of all, the question of an order granting a new trial being review of an order granting a new trial when it's based on a question of law, the review is de novo. And it is on a question of law here, and as far as both whether or not the judge made a comment and whether or not prejudice resulted. And that's what the Dibdahl versus Genesco case says.
So the factual question is what happened?
Right.
The legal questions are what are the legal effects of what was found to have happened?
Exactly. And a judge violates the Constitution by communicating to the jury his or her opinion concerning the truth or falsity of evidence or his or her lack of confidence in the integrity of a witness. A question by the judge will violate the Constitution only if the attitude of the court toward the merits of the cause can be reasonably inferred from the nature or manner of the questions asked and the things said. Washington courts have repeatedly held that a trial judge has discretion to question witnesses. Clarifying questions that do not reveal any new information or only involve peripheral issues do not violate the Constitution. So here, under the facts and circumstances here, Judge Garrett's question merely clarified a question about the source of Dr. Quigley's factual information as to how much blood was on the floor. And there was no dispute at trial that the only source of information about how much blood was on the floor was eyewitness testimony. There were a limited number of people who actually saw the blood, and it was uncontested that none of those people took any pictures or made any measurements or drew any diagrams. This was the only information at trial, the eyewitness accounts, that could be used by any expert to make a decision about how much blood was on the floor.
Even if there was a factual dispute over the amount of evidence, would that change the analysis regarding whether Judge Garrett violated the constitutional provision?
I don't think it would change the analysis, no, because she didn't assume anything. She didn't reveal anything that hadn't been already before the jury in her questions. Nothing in her question assumed any fact. And for example, although she did assume that Dr. Quigley wasn't present at the hospital, which was obviously true and everybody knew that, and she also assumed that he relied on chart notes, which he then denied. But there was no evidence that she assumed in asking the question.
When she uttered that, I find that interesting. So she says, so the information that you've got comes from your reading of the chart notes. That's based on his answer, which was that the information had come from people who were there. That seems to indicate that her notes were actually wrong, and she was attempting to discern whether or not her recordation of the testimony was correct. And he corrects her by saying, no, it was the depositions. Then she says, oh, chart notes and depositions, and he says, no, just the depositions. Is there anything wrong about a judge asking a question to make sure that they have a correct recitation of what the evidence is if they're called upon later on to make a ruling on an evidentiary question or a motion to dismiss?
Absolutely not. That's exactly what the case law has said. A clarifying question by the court is not a violation of the Constitution unless it reveals new information or unless it brings up something in front of the jury that hasn't been there before. For example,
because then it's not really clarifying.
It's not clarifying. It's establishing new evidence. It's bringing new evidence in. And so that is would not have been. I mean, that characterization of Judge Garrett's questions, which I think is completely accurate, again, not a violation of the constitutional prohibition. I think it's also important that the idea of not eliciting new information, Dr. Quigley had already testified on direct that he relied on deposition testimony. Also, two witnesses, certified nursing assistant Ikema and Nurse Little, had already testified. They were eyewitnesses, had already testified, and they had been cross-examined by Mr. Long about whether they had taken pictures or made any measurements. Dr. Zastro had already testified and said that she relied on Nurse Starkovich's account. And then Mr. Long had already presented his entire case, and that included his expert, Dr. Coleman, who testified that his opinion did not depend on the amount of blood on the floor, that he didn't think it could be determined, and also he said, I don't think it's important. There was also nothing in Judge Garrett's words or phrases that indicated she believed or disbelieved any of the information. And finally, as to prejudice, if the court even reaches prejudice, this was a three-week trial with over 25 witnesses. This exchange was brief and isolated. Mr. Long did not object at trial, and he only raised this issue for the first time in his reply brief on his motion for a new trial. Judge Garrett also twice instructed the jury to disregard any perceived comments, and neither party required the jury to determine who saw the blood or how much blood was there. Neither theory of the case from either party required a determination of that. Because there was no comment on the evidence, we ask that you would reverse Judge Ehlich's order granting new trial and reinstate the jury's verdict.
All right, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Doug Shepard. I represent Milton Long. First, as how you parse out the issues before the court, I believe the issues first are whether there were comments, questions, or examinations by the court. That's an issue of law. Second, whether it's prohibited by the Constitution, that's an issue of law. Third, whether it's prejudicial is a factual issue which is based upon abuse of discretion. Now, the problem we have is we don't have a lot of cases where the judges have recused themselves on the issue of their misconduct, and so when the Division One of the court.
Well, that raises the question. How do we deal with that? Because it seems to me that the cases assume that a judge will not recuse themselves. That the entire reason for having an abuse of discretion standard is to have the person who saw the same things as the jury saw and heard the same things as the jury heard make these determinations as to the effect of the questions that were asked and any prejudice. So where does that leave us when we don't have the predicate behind the head notes? We've got a substitute judge, not the trial judge. Is the ruling of the substitute judge entitled to any deference?
I believe it is. We spent 3.5 hours going over all the facts and going over all the circumstances of the hearing, and
But that judge never had the transcript, the complete transcript that we have.
I understand that.
Well, I understand it too. Yeah. And so, why would I be called upon to defer to someone who had less information than I have?
I think this is a case of first impression. If you want to decide it as a matter of law, I'm comfortable with that if you've looked at all the facts. I believe it's an abuse of discretion, but if you want to decide it as an issue of law, there isn't a lot of cases that help you on that subject matter. So I think you could write it any way you want it to, if that makes sense. I believe if you've reviewed the whole record, you realize that it was, in fact, prejudicial.
Well, let's look at what the judge whose ruling is before us said. Clerk's Papers 558 says Dr. Quigley's questions, and it says essentially that the trial court inappropriately asked the following questions, and then it has five instances that appears to quote a transcript. Can you tell me what was inappropriate about any of the questions that the court asked?
Sure. Throughout all of their experts, I've been complaining about foundations. Pre-trial, we've been complaining about foundations. There are two nurses we were complaining about foundations. Before Quigley took the stand, we were complaining about foundations. And so when he gets done testifying, the Peace Health attorney rests, and the judge starts asking what the foundation is for his opinion. And the judge says, which I would hope would be admissible evidence, are you relying upon the medical records? Because the medical records said he was found in a pool of blood. And he says, no, I'm not relying upon the medical records. I'm relying upon depositions. We don't know what depositions. The depositions, in fact, are inadmissible hearsay, so we don't have any facts for foundation. So she says, and the medical records, she, I believe, knows they have to have some foundation. And he says, no, I don't think there's anything in the medical records as regards the amount of blood.
But if this is an expert opinion, does the basis for the opinion have to be admissible?
If there aren't facts, admissible facts and circumstances to support his opinion, it's speculation. It's guesswork. That's what it is.
So if he says, I rely on this, but what I relied on was not itself independently admissible, that means the opinion is not admissible?
Absolutely, if he doesn't have foundation, factual foundations to support his opinion. They don't have to come in before his opinion comes in, but they have to come in before his opinion goes to the jury and before the weight goes to the jury. Yes, they can come in and give a bare opinion and make it subject to cross-examination. Unfortunately, the cross-examination was done by the trial judge, trying to find out what the foundation was.
If this was so prejudicial, as I'm saying, there was no objection to this at the time that it occurred. In the initial motion for a new trial, this particular issue was not raised, and it wasn't raised until reply. So it seems like it was, from the perspective of everyone in the court, it was a fairly innocuous event until now.
Not from my perspective. The night before, we had had a conversation with another of their experts that had been interrupted, and there was an argument in front of the jury, and I asked that the court that we not have evidentiary arguments in front of the jury. As a foundation for this expert, before he gave his opinion, he said, I don't know how much blood there is, I'm guessing. And the judge, I objected to guesswork, and the judge said, that's just vernacular. Now, to be quite frank with the panel, guesswork is vernacular that we use in the courtroom or we use in science.
But if you had objected at the time, and the judge had thought that you were entitled to a remedy, an available remedy would have been to strike the question and strike the answers, right? And then give a curative instruction of the same type that ultimately was given before closing argument.
First, it's a constitution.
Isn't it so? It's not the answer that's constitution doesn't answer it, because it's not one of these structural errors that can't be cured and are always prejudicial. So Evidence Rule 614 governs the court's questioning of witnesses and calling witnesses. And it says that an objection is to be made either at the time or at the soonest opportunity when the jury is not in the room. One of the reasons for that is it gives the court an opportunity to remedy the problem if a remedy is called for. Why wouldn't it be a sufficient remedy for the court if the judge thought you were entitled to a remedy, to strike the court's questions and strike the answers to those questions?
Well, for 37 years of practice, I've never seen this happen to me. My heart was cut out, and I was spent 2 days arguing with the judge in front of the jury and was not getting any ruling on anything. If the court knows the facts and circumstances of this case, the doctor, Zastrow, came and testified about notes she had on her lap.
Yeah, well, we're focusing now, though, on whether or not this appeared at the time to be a problem. By not objecting before the verdict, by waiting to find out the verdict, and then objecting after the verdict, you took away the least intrusive remedy available to the trial court, which would have been to strike the questions and strike the answers, and left the trial court with an all-or-nothing proposition. That doesn't seem to be what's envisioned by Rule 614, which itself addresses comments on the evidence as a basis for objection.
There was nothing I said to the court about their rulings on evidence in this trial that which was listened to or heard. And In fact, I said to co-counsel, every time I'm objecting, every time there's a conversation with the judge in front of the jury, I'm losing the case. It was a very difficult circumstance.
So it was tactical?
No, it wasn't tactical. It was, I believe, when it all got done, I would be able to still argue about foundation because he was talking about the depositions, which were not been admitted yet and was not factual, and he would be dismissed. Instead of me going into cross-examination, Peace Health Counsel then for the next five pages got to lay an additional foundation. I objected to the foundation as to those problems. I made a mistake of believing I could clear it up in my cross-examination, and there were five pages of arguments in front of the judge. In fact, the judge asked us both to step back, where the Peace Health got to build upon that foundation before I even got to cross-examine. I made the mistake of believing that when she was done, I would, in fact, be able to go into cross-examination. I did not know that the whole case would unravel with them being to reopen their direct after that. I thought I would be able to go into the cross-examination. Instead, if you look at the next four or five pages, it got even worse.
Well, counsel, let me get back to my question. And again, I focus on the trial court's written ruling, which is before us, where the trial judge, the judge whose alleged comment on the evidence is the subject of all this, that court or that judge made five statements. The essence of the constitutional provision is that the trial judge has done something to communicate to the jury his or her feelings about the evidence. Would you please tell me what about those five comments by the trial court at Clerk's Papers 558 communicates to the jury any thought about the trial judge's personal view of the evidence? I don't see it, so please explain it to me.
To the court, what is your understanding? Obviously, you went there. I want to know what your information is about the amount of blood. Well, someone described, I forget who it was, I really apologize, 2 inches around the head. I'll get through the rest of it. And the court, okay, so the information that you got comes from reading the chart notes. And the doctor says depositions, which are not in and are not before you. And from the depositions, the court says. Actually, from the depositions, I don't remember reading anything in the chart note that said anything about blood loss. So he's talking about the chart notes not having anything about blood loss, except the chart note said he was found in a pool of blood. Then it goes back. Then the court says, okay, if okay means approval or agreement to the testimony. That's what it means in any definition, that she's agreeing with the testimony of the expert. And then it immediately goes back into Peace Health reopening their case in chief. I don't see okay as anything other than approving their expert's foundation for their opinion based upon evidence that this court doesn't have in front of it. There's no depositions in front of you supporting the amount of blood.
All right, thank you.
Just to address really briefly, the idea about deference to the trial court judge, I don't believe deference to the trial court judge is required even in a case where the trial court judge, him or herself, makes the decision on a motion for a new trial based on a judicial comment on the evidence. We have that happening both in the Risley versus Moberg case and in the Dibdahl case. Both of those cases involved a trial court judge granting a new trial based on judicial comments on the evidence, and when the appellate court reviews the error, it's not in terms of abuse of discretion. There's no deference to the trial court in those two opinions. And so I think, just like here, the fact that it was a different judge that heard the motion after Judge Garrett recused herself, I don't think that changes the standard of review. I think the standard is the same. And I think it's a question of law that the court needs to review de novo, but that also you have even less reason to defer to Judge Ehlich because, yes, he had a hearing where both attorneys presented their impressions of what happened at trial, but he did not have the entire transcript, and he actually didn't know what was important in the case based on how they actually presented their evidence. He just had a recitation from the two attorneys on what they thought was important. So I don't think there's any reason in the law or in the facts here to defer to Judge Ehlich.
Counsel argues vigorously that the court adopted the doctor's testimony when the court said okay. What's your response to that?
That is just not reality. There is nothing in saying the word okay or yes or thank you or any word that just is mostly expressing I hear you. It is not expressing anything about her opinion of whether or not he was telling the truth. And also, it's meaningless. That happens in the Hansen case, where the judge had asked a question and then said to the prosecutor, he's changed. She was talking about how the witness had changed his testimony. But, of course, it didn't really make any sense, and nobody knew what he was talking about. It was meaningless, and therefore it cannot communicate his feelings about the evidence. I also want to just quickly address the idea of foundation. When Judge Garrett asked her questions, she wasn't ruling on a question of admissibility based on foundation. And I would submit that the jury is not interested in the legal description of foundation when they're listening to this. They're not going to be impressed by the judge saying, tell me again what you were relying on as far as whether or not that evidence is admissible. So I think that that is just a red herring, and the foundation argument that he's making and should not be be dispositive in this case. Also, again, no words communicated her opinion about any bit of evidence in this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.